they stop blaming the learner because they understand that, oh yeah, this is how behavior works. There is an explanation for this. It's not that my animal is mean, that I'm a crappy handler. This is just how it works.
Welcome to the Mindset Podcast for guardians of dogs who are just a little rough around the edges. I'm your host, Kajsa van Overbeek, a life coach dedicated to making life with your challenging dog feel less challenging, both by sharing stories of other people's similar experiences and by showing you how you can harness the power of your brain to make it work for you instead of against you. Hi, everyone. I just want to say a little something before the start of this episode. In this episode, you're going to hear Aga talk about her three dogs. And unfortunately, between us recording this episode and it being published, Gacek, one of her dogs, passed away. So I just want to extend my deepest sympathies to Aga and wish her strength to cope with this loss. And I also want to say that if you are dealing with the loss of a loved one, whether it be your dog or a human loved one, please know that grieving is very personal and that there is no right way to do it, that there's no specific set amount of time that it should take. Any way you grieve is fine. And possibly I also want to say, please also know that part of this process is other people not understanding your grief, because they can't. They really, truly can't. It's yours alone. And though other people can support you and help you and be there for you, sometimes they are going to maybe make a remark that doesn't sit well with you, or they're going to say something that shows that they just don't understand. And I want to say, that's probably correct. That's probably true. They don't understand. They can't understand. It wasn't their relationship. It wasn't their loved one, their dog, their friend, their family member. Just know that is part of the process as well. Okay, I think let's get on with the episode.
Welcome to another interview episode of Rough Around the Edges. And you kind of know the drill by now. I tend to tell you not just who I'm talking to, but I don't even know if that's proper English, where I'm talking to. It's not proper English, but I'm making it. So today I am talking with somebody over in Europe, not the US this time, in Poland. And I asked her how to pronounce her name properly. I tried. I think I came close, but I'm not going to go there. I'm just going to call her Aga, like she said I could. And I'm just going to ask her to introduce herself and her dogs and what she does and give us a little spiel so that you know and I can get out of, you know, pronouncing her name or butchering her name. So, Aga, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Kajsa. So it's Agnieszka Janarek, but Aga is absolutely fine. And most of my friends from abroad call me Aga, but also people in Poland and my family too, because it's not some name that was created just for the foreigners. It's also just the name we use in Poland. So yes, but Agnieszka, and I'm a caregiver of three dogs, Gacek, Gabciu, and Gunia. They are, you could say, elderly dogs right now, because Gacek is going to be 15 in January. Gabciu is going to be 14 in February, and Gunia 13. So yes, especially now, Gacek is struggling a little bit with his health, but we hope for the best. He's a super strong little guy. And a little bit about myself. So I'm an animal trainer, a behaviorist. I'm a behavior geek, but also a precision geek. I love digging into precision training and also science-based training. And I'm the founder of animal training platform called Tromplo.
I should probably cut in there, because that's also how I know you. I think I don't even know if it was maybe an ad or I just saw your Facebook group and I joined. Like, I feel like I've been in it for quite a long time and I've always kind of sort of been lurking and following along. So I'm really glad that we're actually getting to talk about this. And I know I'm kind of interrupting, but the first thing you said, and please continue like doing the little intro, but the first thing you said was, I'm also a precision geek. So to me, like precision and perfectionism are sort of like close sisters always, or brothers, or however you want to call it. And I'm wondering if there is overlap between the two for you. But first, you know, like continue the introduction, but keep that in mind. I'm going to ask you about that.
Oh, that's going to be difficult now.
Sorry.
I want to talk about precision and perfectionism. But okay, so yeah, I'm the founder of Trumplo. Trumplo is an online animal training platform for all kinds of species. That was the thing that I really wanted it to be, not just the dog school. But also because, like I said, I'm a precision geek, but also science behavior geek. It's a combination of both. So all the instructors that are teaching there, because it's not just me teaching, it's right now it's 16, oh my God, I didn't check recently, but 16 or 17 instructors altogether teaching at Trumplo. And all these people are connected with background or interest in applied behavior analysis and ethical training. So they all follow positive reinforcement, ethical standards, but also they are very geeky about training in general. So they like to dive deeper. They like to really not just teach the behavior or teach the dog, but to teach the animal, but also understand and look from different perspectives. So it's a place for animal training geeks, definitely. But also people who are just new to training gonna really find things they don't have to worry about whether or not they are good for them or for their animals. And precision, yes, I love precision because I think it's often misunderstood. Often we think that when you want to be super precise about something and teaching behavior. So like I have background with my dogs. We used to compete in nose work and in competition obedience and I'm in trailing too, but competition obedience is like very much people consider it to be very precision based sport. And very often we think that precision is something that is difficult, that can influence motivation, and that's another topic, what is motivation, but that can really be hard for some dogs and that it can be discouraging. And for me it's completely the opposite, because the more precise you are, the more clarity you have in a training session, in a training program, the more enjoying it is and the easier it gets, because you don't have to do super difficult things to be precise. You can do very simple things like delivering treats and be precise at it. And the clarity within it is going to make the training more reinforcing for both sides, actually, for me.
First question about that. Does trying to be precise also need you to do more planning, like on the front end? Do you need to do more thinking about it? Like, because I tend to do both things. I tend to first overthink what I want to do and then never get started. So that's where I'm kind of sometimes going like, okay, no, just do something, you know, like don't start to overthink it, do something. And then of course I fall into the trap of not having really thought about what is actually the precise behavior that I want. What do I want it to look like? How can I shape it better? So my guess is that you spend some time thinking about it on the front end. And then I guess the question that goes along with it is, how do you make sure that you don't get stuck in that planning phase and you also actually start to do something?
Yeah, I think it's a problem when we also get into the errorless training, because people often think about it that, oh my God, I can never make an error. And it's better that I don't start training, because if I make an error, I'm not doing errorless training. And precision and errorless, they really often come together hand in hand. And for me, it's like, it's being errorless and being precise does not mean you are a perfectionist. I really don't want to be a perfectionist, because you're never going to succeed if you have a perfectionist mindset, because we all make errors. Like, we're going to make errors because we don't have enough data. It's just the approach and how you act when there is an error, what you do with an error, like how you bounce back from making an error and how you perceive an error in training. Because in training, an error, like in technically not in training, but in everything, an error is just a feedback. It's just, and also it's errors, they are going to happen because we don't have enough data on our training. We don't really know how the animal is feeling right now. We can assess it through the behavior we're seeing, but we don't know if the animal has a headache right now. And that can influence training, and then error can happen. So it's not that errorless training and precision training is that we avoid errors at all costs, because then it's paralyzing and you're never going to start training. But what we think about when error happens, it's like how you respond. For me, when an error happens, it's an information. Okay, so I got to change something. Like, my plan was not bulletproof, because it never is going to be. It's just feedback, and I just don't dwell too much on errors. I consider errors to be criteria for my next training session. So if I'm making an error, like my training with my animals, but also the sport that I'm doing with myself, when I make error on a training, it's just the information for me. Okay, why did I make it? Like, what happened? Can I tell? If I can tell, I can make another repetition, the correct one. If I can't tell, I'm going to go back to it maybe next session, because if I'm going to keep repeating the same thing, I'm going to make more errors, and it's going to be super frustrating, and I don't want that. So I do spend time planning, definitely. And I'm doing right now less than I used to, but I do a lot of rehearsals without the dogs. So if I want to teach something new, I want to just run quickly through the steps without the dog, just pretending that the dog is there or the other animal. And it helps me avoid unplanned bugs in my plan. But I don't spend too much time on planning before the very first session. I rather start training, and after, of course, I have a plan. I start training, I see how my learner responds, and then I adjust. So I don't want to be in the theory too long, because then I can get stuck and think about too many different solutions. I do want to have always a way to get out of a difficult situation in training. So for me, it's usually resetting with treats. And this way, if an error happens, I can just reset with treats and either change something in the environment or just move on to a different thing I wanted to teach, or like end the training session. So I don't feel like I have to end the training session on something brilliant and correct. I just, like, the whole training session is just a fun experience for me, and hopefully for my learner. So I think that it's good to be able to experiment, because even at the expense of errors, because even I do consider myself to be aiming to become an errorless trainer. But like I said, it's about the approach to errors. It's not about not making an error, because then it's paralyzing and I would never want to train anything, anywhere, and any animal.
Has this always been your sort of approach to life or your attitude in life, or is this something that has come with the years and that has changed? Because you said it very matter-of-factly, like, to me, an error is feedback. It's just feedback on the process. Was that always your thinking? Has that always been you, or have you had to learn that?
Oh, I have to learn that. And I would say my dogs, they have to learn it very hard way. Because at the very beginning, I used to ride horses when I was a kid, professionally. From when I was 6 years old, I got my first horse, and I was in professional horse dressage, and I was competing. I was in the national team, and this was far away from errorless, far away from positive. It was based on negative reinforcement and punishment, because it was like classical horse riding. And my journey started with just loving horses and wanted to spend time with them. And my parents were super great and bought me a horse, and I started to compete. And then it kind of twisted into very wrong direction, into just using horses as a means to an end to achieve something in a competition, because it was the environment around me and I was just a kid. So people, this is how it looked like the horse is there for you to achieve trophies and competition. And then I got more horses and I was just competing, and I realized that I just don't have the time to spend with my horses. It's just me riding them and somebody bringing another horse to ride, and me just switching horses, like no relationship whatsoever. And I quit, and I decided that this is not what I want to do. Like, this is exactly the opposite of why I started horse riding. But it took me a while to realize that. I was 17, almost 17 when I stopped. So 10 years into professional horse riding. And then we got a dog, our second dog, Gacek. He's still with us, when I was 19. And I just wanted to do something with him. And I wanted it to be fun. So I went just for training when I was 19 with him. And we immediately got another dog, Gapcho. And I found out about dog sports. I started to do those dog sports. And slowly I realized that I'm just repeating the patterns from horse riding. I'm doing the same things I used to with my horses, and that this is the opposite of what I want to do. And my dogs were avoiding Gapcho. He started to avoid me. He started to quit because they are all rescued from the shelter and they had their histories, not really good ones. And Gapcho, during competition, he started to avoid me, to run away from obedience ring. And I was like, but why? I'm using treats and everything. I'm just doing good job. But then I realized that I was just pushing him. Like, he had no choice. He had to do it. There was no alternative. There were no cues. There were commands. And he had to obey those commands, right? Then we got Gunya somewhere after, I was a year and a half after we got Gacek and Gapcho. And Gunya is a pit bull cross. And she started to exhibit some problem behaviors, aggressive behaviors. So I was digging deeper and I was really having a hard time to find more resources. So kind of organically, I started to learn more, going to conferences. I found out about Kay Lawrence and I enrolled in her professional trainer's course. That took me 4 years. It was, 4 years to complete and receive certification. And I was just organically getting sucked into the more professional side of animal training, learning that I just don't want to repeat my history of horses. So I stopped competing and I completely reevaluated what I think about learning in general. And then I discovered applied behavior analysis and I realized that there is science that tells us how we all learn, regardless of the species, and that we can know the principles of what works, what doesn't work, why it works, how we can make the training session more effective. Also having a really big emphasis on ethical approach. So I've enrolled in Florida Institute of Technology to do my degree from applied behavior analysis a couple of years ago. And got completely sucked into the ABA world. Having that background in sports training, it's really super cool for me because I like to dive deeper and I like to dissect the behavior. I think really doing some sport, not for the sake of competing, but also following rules that somebody else puts on you, just to get out of your comfort zone and learn things that you probably wouldn't think about learning, is super cool as a training experience. So sometimes I like to follow rules from agility, just to teach something to my dogs, to get out of the comfort zone and stop repeating the same things I've been doing in training, especially when you train on your own. You can get wider horizons and learn more things. So throughout my journey with horses and then dogs, I, especially with Kay Lawrence at the beginning, I came into the understanding that, yes, errors are just feedback and information that we just don't have enough data and there was something missing in our training plan and in our approach, and that we can just try again later or try different maybe.
How did you really internalize that? Because I remember, I think when I first started working with my dog, I wanted to do agility because I have a cattle dog. You know, I was told, you know, cattle dogs are great for dog sports and you have to work them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I was like, okay, agility is going to be the thing. I want to learn from the best. And I bought some courses from Susan Garrett. And one of the things she said was basically, I think she said it in a different world, in different words. So I don't think she said errors are just feedback, but something along the lines of it's all just information, something of the sort. And I got that message, kind of, but the way I heard it was, yes, it's all just information and it's telling me how I'm doing everything wrong. Okay. And I took that pretty hard in the beginning. I was like, I suck as a trainer, not that I'm a professional trainer, but as a trainer of my dog. I suck at it. Yeah, it's information, but it's information on how crappy I'm doing. Were you able to separate that out really as, no, it's just a feedback on the situation, on the behavior, and not take it personal from the start?
I think listening a lot to first with Kay Lawrence, then Susan Friedman, Dr. Susan Friedman, Ken Ramirez, and just trying this approach, even not internalizing it yet, but maybe trying it with my own dogs was definitely something that showed me that this is actually the way to go. Otherwise, I'm not going to be like the more I'm going to be more successful and they're going to be more successful. And it's all going to be fun experience if I'm just going to let go of the pressure. And I was working on it quite hard, especially also in my sports without the dogs. But then I think that at some point it became, when I started studying ABA, it was kind of obvious for me that errors are not necessary for learning to occur, but they just happen. Like, you don't have to make errors to learn something, which is cool, but they will happen because it's impossible to avoid them at some point. And they're just information, they are feedback on whatever is happening there. And the fact that we are not doing brain surgery, I think, also makes it easier. That like, nobody's going to die if I'm going to make error and my dog's going to do a crooked sit.
That's for sure. This might be a nice sort of segue into what is errorless learning. So I think it's the term that a lot of people have heard about, and I'm not sure that everybody really knows what it entails. To me, the first time I heard it, I was like, okay, learning without making errors, which obviously, as we've just discussed, not going to happen. Errors will happen. Can you explain the concept behind it?
Yeah. Errorless for me, because I think that like the first time the term was coined and talked about was research done on pigeons with Torrance. And he was talking about teaching a pigeon to discriminate without making errors. So without giving two options and reinforcing just one. So differential reinforcement. Just, can we do it differently? Can we teach the animal to discriminate without making those errors at the beginning? And the answer is yes, we can, which is super cool because it's great that you don't have to repeat the unwanted behaviors and actually get better at it. Because when you think about it in a way that when you make errors one after another, you're getting better at this. You're getting better at being wrong, actually. You don't want to make errors in training because they're not going to get you closer to your goal. So the fact that we don't need to make an error to learn is super cool. But on the other hand, it's not about not making those errors because even Skinner at the very beginning, he said that errors are not necessary for learning to occur. They are happening because we don't have enough data. We made unclear training progression, but an organism can learn without errors. So like the baseline of the whole assumption that you can actually learn a skill without making a single error is super cool. But it's also overwhelming, like I said at the beginning, and it doesn't have to be because we can look at the error list more from the perspective of constructing something rather than fixing what is broken already. So it comes for me, errorless training is about creating the environment that facilitates really clean learning, really fast progression forward without deliberately making the learner to make an error. And deliberately, I think, is the crucial word here because the errors, they will happen, like we said already, but we don't plan for them. We don't make the training progression that involves, yes, you have to make an error to learn that this is wrong and this is right. That's the opposite. We teach what is the correct behavior. We teach the correct progression. And then we can fade in more challenging distractions, the environments. So it's like, for example, with teaching your dog to leave the food on the floor or in your hand. So traditional leave it exercise. It was taught in the first place by opening and closing your hand with food, right? You put the food in there and the dog was approaching it. So we were closing it and just reinforcing, delivering when the dog just moved away. But when you look at it from the error perspective, the animal that tries to get into your hand, it's making one error after another. We can avoid it completely, which is super cool because you can first teach your animal what to do when the food is somewhere really far away, like on the top shelf, and then gradually just fade in the food. So you're reinforcing the behavior that the animal is performing, let it be stand, for example, and you feed the cookies while dropping the food lower and lower, and finally can put it on the floor. And the animal did not try even once to get to that treat because you're already feeding him. Yeah, you're already feeding him. And you have the behavior that you wanted to see, for example, stand. And then I can go from there to heel work where the food is on the ground and my dog will be walking around food and he never actually tried to get that food. And even if he did, okay, it means that maybe I went just too fast or maybe it was just a too fast progression this time. And that's totally fine. So the next time I'm going to do it differently. It's not going to be a problem. So when error happens, for me, the most important thing is just to move forward to ensure that the next repetition of whatever that's going to be, it's going to be that correct one that's going to get reinforced. And even if I'm going to toss treats for an error, I'm not going to click it, I'm just going to toss treats. It's just a reset. It's just like, okay, nothing happened. Let's move on. Let's move on to something else because I cannot just rewind and go back in time and just clean up the slate. That won't happen. The thing got there. So what I want to do is make sure that the rest of a training session is as fluent as possible and that I can move on forward as quickly as I can.
Now that I hear you talk about it, I'm thinking like, I think I probably taught my dog recall and leaving food in a sense in that way, because there was sort of a recall with an empty bowl way by the side, you know, and then the bowl coming a little bit closer and then food was in the bowl and then the bowl was filled and he recalled past the bowl. So the bowl was sort of faded in to the recall. So that kind of sounds like what you are describing.
It's fading in, not fading out, because usually errors, we base them like, let's make it super difficult and then we're going to just take away a little bit of things. And you can start from the other way around. You can fade in, not fade out. So instead of just starting with that food, you're going to fade it in very gradually.
What kind of things do you teach using this method? Or is this sort of the basis for everything that you teach?
Yeah, I would say it's the basis, like the foundation of everything that I teach right now. I do want to be as much, like I don't want to use extinction, because extinction, operant extinction, so withholding reinforcement for something that used to bring that reinforcement, because this is super frustrating. We usually label all the behaviors that happen during extinction process frustration behaviors. And it's a crappy environment to learn. If you imagine like even yourself, somebody is asking you to guess what they think, right? And you're going to get your food only when you're going to guess right. And they can think about like they want you to stand on your left leg with your arms lifted up and you got to figure it out. It's going to be really super hard if they're not going to give you, and they are giving you some clues, but they're completely like ridiculous and you don't get it. This is frustrating. And they are using extinction because they are not clicking, not reinforcing your behavior until you get it right. And I don't want to put my learner in that position. So whatever I do, I want to make sure that I am minimizing the extinction process, the errors, and that even if the error happens, I do have a backup plan what to do to ensure that just the experience of learning together is fun.
How do you use that same process with your clients? Because I'm imagining, right, we're not just teaching animals, not just dogs in your case, animals. We're teaching what I call the guardians. I don't like calling us owners. Yeah. How do you apply that to the humans?
Cool thing is that, you know, the ABE, the science applies to all species. So we learn the same way that our animals do. Yes, as animal trainers, we work with humans mostly, and they work with animals. This is the paradox of people who, I went into animal training business to work with animals, and you never work with animals. You work with humans mostly. You work with your own animals usually.
Yeah, and, exactly.
And then we work with human animals. And this is exactly the same because you teach them using errorless approach. So you break down the skills you want to teach them, making sure that they don't make those errors. And you respond to errors like it is feedback. You give them just feedback and teach them to be more independent and learn that skill of noticing that an error is just a feedback and what it means. And for me, it starts with very foundational behaviors. I really like to teach people to focus on foundations and really basic skills, because from those very, like what Ken Ramirez said once, I'm going to paraphrase him, that advanced training are just basics done really, really well. I agree with it like 100% because we often tend to skip through the foundations and then we really want to teach those sexy, cool behaviors, but we forget about clarity in the delivery process, about clean loops in training. Then we see more and more unwanted behaviors, more problem behaviors. We didn't really spend some time being learners ourselves. And I always tell my clients that like their animals, they are also learners. And sometimes it's really difficult to be in a position of being a teacher and a learner in the same place. Because when they are working with their animal, they are both, usually. If they are not professionals, but even if they are professionals, they are both learning at that moment and teaching. So sometimes it's better to focus just on one thing. Just focus on your skills sometimes and have that mindset that you're a learner right now and your animal is just helping you. We're just going to feed him plenty of cookies, but because we are going to focus on what you are doing. It's going to really be beneficial for you in the future training. I think that when people notice that when they can get really clean training, even at those very foundational things, or those what we may perceive as easy things, they get really excited. They notice that it helps them to build more advanced progression very quickly when they become fluent at foundations. They see that if they really follow the approach of minimizing extinction and making the environment supportive for the learner, also themselves, it's so much easier on both sides. I think it's just about the how we communicate with our human learners, how we explain to them why it's beneficial for them. And if we as animal trainers can teach the human learners the same way we teach animals.
What are the basics for you? Because you mentioned, you know, it's expert behaviors are the basics done really well. What are the basics for the humans that you want to teach them or that you want to them to really understand?
So I definitely want them to understand how behavior works. I want them to understand and to notice in practice how reinforcement works, how punishment works. Because when they notice, like, so they can see that what they are doing, for example, inadvertently, is negative punishment or extinction, so that they can catch it and change something because they don't want to use it. If they understand the science behind it and they can apply it in training, this is extremely helpful. And they stop blaming the learner because they understand that, oh yeah, this is how behavior works. There is an explanation for this. It's not that my animal is mean, that I'm a crappy handler. This is just how it works. So if I want to work differently, I just got to have to change something. Also, the clarity of delivery, the teaching eating as a behavior, which I really emphasize on with all learners, that we use food as reinforcer across so many behaviors and so many situations that we often forget that we need to teach eating as a behavior because eating is an operant behavior. So I do want to focus on teaching eating to fluency because if it is the easiest behavior and your animal can't eat under in certain conditions and you expect them to perform some cues, it's not going to happen. First, focus on building that. Also, into reading your dog, so making sure that you understand those behavioral changes and how your dog responds to distractions. If the environment is too difficult, making sure that the dog has the time to acclimate and building training a routine that involves choice options for your dog or your learner, your animal, so that your dog can say, cooperate and can communicate with you that he is still in the game or no, thank you. I'm this is enough for me, so that we can respect choice. So the choice concept, like operationalize it, and loopy training. So what is loop? What are antecedents, behavior, consequence? How we are working in those behavior loops? How to make sure there's clarity there? I guess these are foundations for me.
Another question on extinction and sort of in line with this whole keeping everything clean. What some people argue, and I think this is something that I'm still struggling with myself as well, is that being able to deal with frustration is also a skill that can be useful. Mm-hmm. In your training, I think what I'm hearing, and it's usually what I try, because it frustration, for example, in me, and frustration in my dog Rusty, that just messes up our training, so it's generally not useful. So I try to limit it. But on the other hand, I sometimes think, am I making it too easy? Am I now not teaching my dog frustration tolerance? Should I be teaching him that? How important is it to be able to deal with frustration? Like, what's your take on that?
I think that there is a misunderstanding that we need. This is actually the same as with an error. People think like you have to learn no to understand yes. So, for example, you can learn that the sign for at the restroom that says vacant is, it means that you can enter without actually trying to enter when it's occupied. You don't have to make an error to learn. And the same about what we call resilience. And resilience, I think Dr. Susan Friedman once said, it's an ability to bounce back. So it's how you respond when an error happens. And for me, ability to be resilient to errors is about how many skills you have to apply in the situation. So if an error happens and you have to move forward and do something else, can the history of reinforcement tell you what to do, or you lack those skills? So for me, ability to deal with frustration, with errors, and being resilient is about having many different skills across many different conditions. And the more skillful you are, for example, if it's heel work, for example, and my dog and I, we're doing heel work routine on a ring, obedience ring, and I stumble and I just fell on the ground, right? It's a clear error. It's a situation that my dog maybe was never in. And the fact that we train heel work in multiple locations, he has skills and reinforcement history that tells him that coming back to heel work and performing certain behaviors is going to be heavily reinforced. It's what's going to keep him going. He doesn't need to deal with frustration behaviors and extinction to learn that if there is an unexpected situation, to go back to the behavior that was previously reinforced. I think the reinforcement history is what really gives us resilience in training.
I'm trying to figure out how that would play out in situations. For example, I'm just thinking, let's say you have a very exuberant dog that just wants to greet all other dogs. And so when they don't get to greet the other dog, that is going to lead to frustration. I guess what you're saying there is that that could be a situation in which the solution is to teach the dog a lot of coping skills or skills in how to deal with situations like that. I'm not even sure that I know where I want to go with this question, but maybe you can just tell me, like, what in your approach, how would you deal with the situation?
Like, if the dog wants to meet every dog, and we have to, for the sake of like safety and everything, limit it, and so you don't start training that behavior in the most difficult conditions, because you probably spent some time teaching the dog to actually greet every single dog he encountered, because it's not out of the blue, or the dog, like, the history of reinforcement tells the dog that this is, well, this is what it used to work. So you want to first teach a different behavior that you can use in that context, and that behavior has to be trained to fluency. It's like, you don't start training heel work in the competition, right? Start training it at home in the indoor venue or somewhere where there are limited distractions. It's like with recall. You don't start training recall when your dog really chases wild animals. You don't start training in the middle of the forest surrounded by deers, because that's not going to happen. And the same with dogs jumping or wanting to greet other people. You don't start there. You start in the easier environment and you build the progression. And then you can use what we call NCR, which is non-contingent reinforcement. So you deliver a preferred stimuli. For example, a dog jumps on a human every time the person comes back from work, right? And it's very hard to actually start training any other behavior because you will have to either use extinction to get that moment where the dog is not jumping on you, right? So what you can do in the first place is just start delivering treats on the ground and do it regardless of what the dog does. After a while, you're going to see that the dog expects treats to be placed on the ground. You will get that couple of seconds when your dog is not jumping on you. You can start training from there. So it's like slightly cleaning the slate for you to start training in an easier contingency, not so difficult that the dog is performing unwanted behavior all the time. So sometimes we can actually take a completely different approach and start delivering things that the dog cares about in abundance and with or things that maybe it's great if these things are the functional reinforcers. So with dogs wanting to greet other dogs would be other dogs, but that's impossible for the safety reasons and other dogs, obviously. So you can just deliver treats and then in different contexts, teach different behavior and then move that to a context of feeding. So it's all a matter of progression and not having those unrealistic expectations that if something was taught and reinforced for a very long time, we expect it to change in those most difficult conditions with one behavior change protocol because it's not going to happen that quickly.
Of course, we do want that to happen really quickly because we're also human. How do you deal with your own frustration?
Like in general or in
training? Yeah, in general. Yeah, maybe not. Yeah, maybe let's go general. Because I guess in training, my guess is, but correct me if I'm wrong, that throughout the experience and the knowledge that you've gained, that the amount of times that you get frustrated probably has decreased, especially with a mindset that says, okay, well, this is feedback. But that might not be the case. This might be an assumption of mine that's not correct. Just considering if you also see frustration simply as feedback or how you handle it. And yeah, like feel free to put it in a dog training context or take it completely out of it.
So recently on my training, my coach, because I'm doing tricking, it's a combination of aerial arts with like aerial combinations with martial arts, usually some kicks. So you're doing tucks, you're doing flips and all these weird things. So recently, a thing that was really working well stopped working because I was learning one skill and then we moved to a different thing. And when you start doing different elements, they influence the one that you were taught, like with, you know, with everything. That's normal. But then I was like, oh my God, why did it work recently? I mean, it did work. Why it's not working right now? And my coach was like, it doesn't matter. We are just doing repetitions. We are breaking it down into smaller pieces. And it really doesn't matter if it worked or didn't work. Some training is just to make repetitions of the correct motor patterns. And even if those motor patterns are different today than they were yesterday, it doesn't matter. It's like going on a journey. If you're getting from point A, like you're going on holidays and you have to drive, I don't know, 600 miles. And you still have to go through the first mile, but that first mile is not really as important in the whole journey, right? It is necessary to get to the final mile, but you don't have to really be focused on it. It doesn't have to be perfect. You don't look at this 1 mile and analyze, was this actually the best mile that I ever had in this journey? Like, you don't do that, right? And I don't think we have to do it in the training because, and this is how I deal with a frustration if something doesn't work. It's usually not with animals because I've learned to completely let go of expectations in my training with my animals. But with myself, yes, I still have to work on that. But I have a great coach who works with me on my behavior. And for me, it's like training is a journey. What this training today, I'm not going to probably remember it in a year, but I have to do that training to get to the next year. It's part of the journey, but it's not the most important training. And not every training is going to be a breakthrough and doing something amazing every time because it's not how it works. I don't dwell on my errors and my, I don't want to even say failures. I don't consider them failures. I just spent maybe a minute or two to analyze what went wrong in terms more mechanical and then move on and do something else. And often I never try to with both with animals and my trainer with me. Sometimes if something doesn't work, with animals, I never do that anymore. I used to. I want to do one more repetition with myself. And I'm asking my coach, like, can I do one more? And, you know, the three previous reps were not going well. And he says, like, but why do you want to do it? You're going to repeat the motor pattern that wasn't working. You don't think that magically something's going to happen that you're going to get it right. And if we are going to make five more repetitions and the fifth one is going to be the good one, what did you actually practice? And what I practiced was incorrect motor patterns for four repetitions. And the fifth one was, well, good. Okay. But what was practiced more? The ratio of correct to incorrect was not in favor.
So if I'm hearing you say it, it's both. It's a combination of this seeing your own, I'm going to put it between air quotes, people can't see, errors. I don't know, maybe we should even say the not desired outcome or the incorrect outcome. It all sounds kind of negative. And seeing that as feedback, plus keeping in mind the final destination and seeing that this is just a small part of it. And this is not, like, in the grand scheme of things, this isn't going to make the difference.
Yeah, the journey itself it's also kind of a destination. We just have to enjoy, like, have fun with this training. It's whatever we do. It's not something we usually start doing it for, you know, to have quality time with our animals. Then suddenly it becomes this brain surgery, stressful thing that we put so much pressure on. It just, you know, I don't want to say it's a bonding time with the animal, and it's fun, simply fun. So we should really have more, for me, it's about also a playful attitude to training. Consider it slightly entertaining for you and the animal, whatever you do together.
Why do you think we do that? That we go to, you know, that we make this switch from, like, we start out having fun and then all of a sudden we get, you know, we get into it and then has to look a certain way. Do you have a theory on that?
It's definitely the environment around us that promotes it. When you want to start, for example, running, right? And you're going to Google it and you're going to go into some forums, you're going to learn that without, you know, six pairs of your sneakers, it's not worth trying, right? That you have to have one pair for gravel, one for treadmill. And you say, like, but I just want to start. Yeah, but if you start wrong, it's pointless. You have to build, like, the good from the start. You have to do it right. And then it's really overwhelming. Everywhere, we also get so much information right now that we can actually be really good in everything we do, because there is potential there. You have access to practically all the knowledge there is, and it's like so difficult not to use it. But then it becomes overwhelming, and we really have this pressure of, I have the resources, so why am I not executing what I've learned? And I can be better. And we forget why we started it and that it should be fun.
Speaking of environment,
mm-hmm.
And what that does to us. I think I saw in your about section, also on the website of Tromplo, that you started out studying law. Am I correct?
Yeah.
And then you switched completely to mm-hmm. applied behavior and animal training. Tell me a little bit about that switch, and also tell me a little bit about what did your environment think of that? Were they all aboard, so to say, right from the start? How did you handle that? Because I know a lot of people that make switches from things like law or being a doctor to then entering the dog training field or becoming an entrepreneur, which is risky in itself, and the environment not necessarily understanding it and having their, let's put it mildly, opinions about it. Were they supportive in your case? Tell me how that happened.
Like, my whole family, it's like entrepreneurs, so they know how it works. And I've always said I'm just going to have my own company from the start. Then the law was my choice, but already being at the university, I knew that it's not going to be my career path. So I was just doing it because it wasn't that hard. I was already working with the animals. So when I graduated, when I got my master's, it started to grow organically. So when I decided that I was teaching seminars, I opened Nose Work Poland Association, because we didn't have nose work in Poland. And I really wanted to see this sport in my country. So I opened the first association, and I was teaching, like, when you open an association of the sport that does not exist in the country, you have to teach the judges, you have to like create the infrastructure for it. So it was a lot of just going and teaching seminars. I started to teach abroad. I was going to conferences, and the law was never a thing. Like, I graduated and that's it. My family was, they knew I'm not going to have a career in law. Like, the moment that I'm going to leave the university, I'm not going back to that department. They knew it. they were okay. They are still very supportive with whatever I do. So that's really cool. But yeah, I always wanted to work in my own company. And then when I was already teaching the seminars and my infrastructure of teaching online courses via Facebook was not enough because there were too many people, like I was getting really hectic on all those groups. So I decided that I need a platform for that. And then this like kind of organically grew into Trumplow. I knew that it's going to be so much easier having other people around and team of instructors, like-minded people, because I was already traveling to conferences and really getting into the industry. I was really lucky to be working with, and I asked many of my friends if they would be interested in teaching for Trumplow, and they all said yes. So it was a wonderful start at the beginning. I don't know if it was even a transition. It was just like organically growing. Like, yeah, it was a very smooth process for me.
Were there any challenges? Because I know usually the switch to having people come work for you, from being a solo entrepreneur to then having multiple people work for you, is a big one. Did you feel it like that? Like, was there anything you had to overcome, any difficulties? Or again, was it just, I almost can't imagine that it was smooth, but who knows, you know, maybe it was errorless.
It's more like it was working with people is, I mean, it's always a compromise of sort. So I'm lucky, I think, that I work with people who are into applied behavior analysis, because we understand how we all learn and how to talk to each other about maybe some complicated matters. And we all, of course, have had a share of like disagreements, because that's totally okay, but nothing really serious. It's more, challenges are more, I would say, from the infrastructure and building new website, working with social media that I absolutely hate. I'm not talking about posting on social media, but the apps, the Meta, Facebook and Instagram, and they are really making it super difficult. The biggest thing is reaching out to people when you don't have unlimited resources for advertising. This is the thing that I think all entrepreneurs, especially like small middle groups, they struggle with, because we are very dependent right now on social media. Like, all on the algorithms, the fact that you're going to get to someone, you're going to get clients, and you're going to get reach is usually solely dependent on if you hit the algorithms, and it's not easy. I think that's the biggest challenge for me running, especially online company, is working with social media and reaching people.
Maybe as a final question, kind of before I go and ask you to comment on the three words that I always ask everyone to comment on. I know a big thing in the dog training industry is burnout at the moment. It's also emotional burnout, overwhelm about seeing all the bad stuff that's happening in the training world. How do you deal with that?
I really like to have different things in my life that I dedicate myself to, and one is sport, not dog sport. And also, like, I meditate a lot. So this is my way to deal with stress and to really dedicate the time for work and dedicate time to relax and just think about problems in a way that they're going to be there tomorrow. If I'm going to take a break, it's not they going to magically disappear, but I don't have to think about them all the time. I can come back tomorrow and they're going to wait for me there, unfortunately, but I can take the afternoon off, and it's not going to be the end of the world. And sometimes doing minimum is sometimes enough, and you're going to need it. And sometimes you just need to take a break and just give the time to yourself, not aim to be perfect, because if you aim to be perfect, you're just going to fail, because we are not, like, no one is perfect. Being able to This is hard because having a distance to like what happens on social media is an important one, but it's easy to say. But for me, it's post, I comment, but I really don't emotionally engage with any of the discussions. And I also consider my platforms, like my Instagram, my Facebook, or Trumpless Instagram, my platforms. So if you go there and if you comment the things that are promoting something that I disagree with, that it's hurtful, or you are being unkind to the people that are following me, I don't have a problem with blocking people or just, you know, not really engaging and not commenting and deleting comments that are threatening, for example, for someone. For me, definitely having other things to do and being able to just take a break is super important.
I mean, the three words I always ask everyone to comment on are expectation, frustration, and celebration. And we've touched on them already quite a bit. But I just want to ask you, like, maybe it's going to be a summary of what we've already talked about. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's something completely new. But when I tell you those three words, what comes up for you? Both, I guess we can do the same thing, like both in general and when it comes to life with, I'm just going to say animals, because Tromblot is about more than dogs. Tell me what comes up for you.
Expectation. Sorry. Expectation. The first word that comes usually with expectations for me is unrealistic, because we usually have unrealistic expectations, and also expectations of others. So sometimes you really have to think whether what you're expecting to teach your dog, yourself, is what you want to do or what is perceived as a standard by society. So for example, I really don't care if one of my dogs, like if Gunya, is okay in the city environment, because we don't live in a city. She is 13 already. She's going to be 13. I mean, she's 12, but she's going to be 13 next year. She's been to the city a couple of times. She usually goes for a walk on the beach or in the forest. I really don't have to spend time teaching her things that are would be appropriate if we lived in the city. And the other way goes, you know, it's the other way around too. So I think that we don't need to have meet the expectations of others. And this is like what come the fuzz that I have on expectations, I think, also. The other one was frustration.
Frustrations,
right?
Yep.
Yeah, so immediately extinction and arrows. Yeah, so this one is like frustration is not the optimal learning environment. My definitely go-to solution for training is make sure that the environment is not frustrating, because it's not the best way to learn in that place.
And then?
Celebration.
Celebration.
Celebrate the journey, I think. Don't just, you know, but don't be, celebrate small steps. Just don't expect also, this is goes back to the maybe expectation a little, that every single training you're going to have is going to be the breakthrough and the most amazing training or amazing learning moment that you will have in your life, because like it doesn't happen like this. And small things are really worth celebrating. It's never going to be perfect. It's sometimes important to just focus on the good. I mean, this is cliche, but really it's like really focusing on the good parts. It's a cool thing. It's a cool habit to have.
It's cliche, but it's what I teach all my clients and what I regularly still remind myself of. Like, what are the good things today? What are the wins? What worked?
Yeah.
I want to ask you also where people can find you. And I know that you've written a book, so I do want you to talk to me a little bit about that. And I realized I do this more often. That's just the way my brain works. So sorry, people. I have one more question, because I just heard myself say Tromblot is also about working with other animals. It's mm-hmm. not just about dogs. What are the other animals that you also work with? And do you find that there are lots of differences? I've kind of already heard you say, you know, behavior, it works the same. Learning works the same for us as it does for the dog. So I'm going to assume that there might be the same thing happening with the other animals. But just could you briefly comment on that and then tell us more about your work?
Tromblot definitely is focused on multiple species. We used to have class for kids. Yes, our instructors were teaching cooperative care airless and positive reinforcement based for small kids. So teaching tooth brushing and going to the doctor and all those stuff with positive reinforcement. It was super cool. All species are welcome. I used to have as my students, I had a turtle from those less common species. Ferrets, hamster, cats are very common, horses. We used to have a trombone, pigs, parrots, goats, cow, chickens, birds of different kinds. Yeah, parrots, I said already. I once had a fish. Yeah, a recall with a fish.
You're kidding me.
No, people wanted to teach fish recall because the fish, like, they bought a house with a pond, and every time they got closer, the fish were swimming away, and they wanted the fish to come when they come. So we were teaching fish recall. It was super, like, it was not very difficult, but yeah, fish too, right? You know, fish is an animal. The differences is, I think I like this quote, why we use it when we work with animals. We also use different sciences, like ethology, for example. And Dr. Susan Friedman said that we use ethology not to teach pigs to fly, because you learn about the species preferences. Of course, you work with the learner in front of you, and the dog in front of you may like this one, this particular dog, although the whole species may prefer sausage to carrots, this one likes carrots more, right? So we have to focus on the one in front. But in general, you're not going to focus on teaching a pig to fly if you know that this species cannot fly, right? This is why we should learn the background about the species, but then you're working with the learner in front of you. The laws are the same, but it's good to know about the species preferences, needs, routines, and incorporate into your training. But other than that, it's really cool to at least try to work with different species, because it gives you a different perspective. Like people working with snakes, for example, they learn a lot of patience because, you know, they are slower than, for example, dogs. Then you really are grateful when working with dogs because they really respond faster to many things. Yeah, I think it's the more species you can work, the better you understand the whole learning science, and you're getting better at practice too.
So good. Now the book.
Tell me about the book. It was released on Monday, so it's kind of fresh. It's available on Trumplo website, and it's called Animal Trainer's Comprehensive Handbook. It focuses on how animals learn in the first place. It's definitely for all the species, because you can adjust the exercises to any animal you're working with. And we are building a foundational skill, a concept, actually breaking it down to teachable units, attention and focus. And so that we can work with the animal in what I call a focus bubble, so that you are not competing against the environment, you are not working against the environment, but your learner is willingly and really joyfully joining you and saying yes to a training session and working with you and making sure that you learn about the principles of errorless learning and how to build clean loops in a training session. It's a really dive deeper. It can be great for novice trainers, but also for advanced, even professionals who just want to clean up their training and get into errorless mindset.
So am I correct in thinking that it deals really with getting the basics perfect?
Maybe not perfect.
Exactly. Not perfect.
But it's about basics, getting basics to fluency.
Yeah. Oh, I like that word, fluency, over perfect. It's funny how perfect is the first word that came to mind after we've just been talking about that so much. People, as always, you don't need to write this down. We're going to link to everything. Awesome. You mentioned the website already. But just give us all the places where they can find you. So the website, trombleau.com, and what about social media?
Social media, yes, like Instagram with my name or Tromplos. There is a Tromplos account and my account, Facebook and TikTok. recently. You can also find the podcast, but if you go to trumplaw.com, you're going to see podcasts out there. There is a DocReel Talk and AGA podcast. Both are available. The DocReel Talk was a series where I just interviewed many different trainers and specialists, also who are working with human learners too.
Awesome. Okay. As mentioned, we're going to link up to all of that. AGA, I want to thank you so much for making this work, for taking the time out of your day, out of your busy day, to come on the podcast and basically talk about, I think we're going to dub it learning this episode. It's all about learning. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Drew. I really appreciate you having me here. I had a great time and I really like what we talked about and the diversity of everything we did. It was super cool. So thank you so much for having me.
You can find the show notes to this episode and everything coaching on my website, kaisavanoverbeek.com, or you can go find us on Instagram at the Rust Cattle Dog, or maybe even Facebook, Kaisa van Overbeek Coaching. If you like listening to this podcast, might I ask you for a good review on whichever platform you're listening to the podcast to, because it helps us move up in the rating, which helps us be found more easily so that more people can listen to this, more people can benefit from it, more people can feel, as I always say, less alone in where they stand with their dogs.